Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Side 2 of For the Record program number 468, titled Through a Glass Darkly, a Look at the 2004 Elections. This is being recorded on 7/11/2004. In this side, we're going to continue with our discussion of Darth Nader, Chairman Ralph, old shoplifter face, as I call him. We're going to take a look specifically at some of the skullduggery that Nader has engaged in the past, in deep-sixing the political fortunes of some of his close associates. In particular, we're going to take a look at Nader's providing of disinformation to the FBI in order to trash the career of a former very close aide named Mark Jacobs. We're also going to take a look at Nader's backstabbing of some of his other collaborators in various regards as well. This against the background of Nader's getting money from Republicans and apparently tactical assistance from Rupert Murdoch as well in recent months. We took a look at that inside one. Following that, we're going to take a look at another wolf in sheep's clothing, so to speak, or someone who certainly would appear to be that, and that is Al Sharpton, the flamboyant African-American preacher who proved very fractious indeed in the 2001-2002 elections, in the 2002 elections in New York. Interestingly enough, Al Sharpton has had his political campaign managed by a guy named Roger Stone. Roger Stone was the Bush aide and extreme right-winger who organized the mob whose activities basically forced the halting of the Miami-Dade recount vote in 2001. A very strange person indeed to be shepherding the candidacy of Al Sharpton. Following that, we're going to take a look at an altogether hypothetical consideration in this election, namely predictions by a number of seismologists of a possible major earthquake in California later this year, when the Gruppenführer, Arnold Schwarzenegger, was elected governor of California. I noted some of his expressed Nazi sympathies and some of the Nazi heritage he brings to the table, and I also wondered about having a Republican in charge of one of the key states in the 2004 elections, and one of the things that I was worried about was the possibility that an earthquake might be triggered, thereby certainly perhaps delaying the elections or forcing the cancellation or the neutralization of some of the vote in some areas. If it's a sufficiently severe earthquake, it could even lead to the collapsing of the U.S. economy, a declaration of martial law, who knows? But I noted that when Schwarzenegger was elected. I've discussed that in a number of programs, including, for the record, 434 and 440. And a number of seismologists have been forecasting earthquakes for later this year in California. So we're going to take a look at an item that falls in that gray area between reality and paranoia. As I said on side one, that dividing line has been very much obscured by the actions of King George II. We're going to return once again to discussion of Darth Nader, once again from Salon.com. This is an article by Lisa Chamberlain, dated July 1st of 2004. It's titled, The Dark Side of Ralph Nader. And what we're going to be taking a look at is Nader's behavior vis-a-vis some of his associates. In particular, we're going to take a look at his attack on a fellow named Mark Jacobs, or Theodore Jacobs, excuse me, a former close associate who had been one of Nader's right-hand men and whose career Ralph Nader trashed when he basically provided disinformation to the FBI, which led to the neutralization of much of Jacobs' professional career. Skipping down in the article, while Nader continues to campaign against corporate abuse, his own record, according to many of those who have worked closely with him, is characterized by arrogance, underhanded attacks on friends and associates, secrecy, paranoia, and mean-spiritedness, even at the expense of his own causes. If he were a corporate CEO, subject to the laws governing publicly held and federally regulated firms, there can be little doubt he would have been removed long ago by his company's board of directors. Nick Jacobs' blood boils every time he sees another poll showing Nader within striking distance of costing John Kerry the election. For him, it isn't just that Nader was indispensable in President Bush's 2000 victory over Al Gore. Nader's latest run for president is infuriating for personal reasons as well. Quote, "He puts himself out there as pure as the driven snow, and he isn't," says Jacobs. "He's paranoid, secretive, and manipulative at best. It galls me that he talks about how corrupt the two-party system is when he trashed someone to the FBI who was his best friend, unquote. That someone was Jacobs' father, Theodore Jacobs. Ted Jacobs met Nader when they were both freshmen at Princeton and then attended Harvard Law School together. Later, as an attorney in private practice, Ted provided personal and professional legal assistance to his old college friend after he was catapulted to national prominence over the issue of automobile safety with the publication of Unsafe at Any Speed. Ted became, in effect, Nader's chief of staff. And from 1970 to 1975, Ted was executive director of the Center for Study of Responsive Law, the first organization Nader founded. The two men's ugly and painful falling out, in which Nader trashed Jacobs to the FBI when Jacobs was up for a federal job, and Jacobs retaliated with an explosive affidavit alleging financial and legal improprieties by Nader, was the first of many destructive breaches between Nader and one-time allies. The story hasn't been told before, but the Jacobs family recently made private papers available to Salon that document the sad split. Quote, "My dad kept everything," said Jacobs. "He had boxes of papers in our basement. They pretty much sat there until Nader announced that he was going to run again, and I decided to go through them," unquote. Nick was shocked by his discovery of this dark chapter in his father's otherwise enemy-free life. In various articles from the early 1970s, Ted Jacobs was described as Nader's closest friend and advisor and the person who stood, quote, "between Nader and the world, absorbing the fury of the attacked, offering solace to the ignored, always speaking the absolute truth within the limits of what he believes Nader would wish him to reveal," unquote. But according to the private papers shared with Salon, he informed Nader sometime in 1974 that he planned to leave the Center for the Study of Responsive Law, but would first finish several projects. On March 8th of 1975, Jacobs arrived at the office to find the contents of two large file cabinets missing, including his personal diaries and documents relating to financial matters, unquote, and his desk drawers ransacked. Nader arrived at the office a short while later to tell him he had ordered the files removed. In a state of near shock, Jacobs tendered his resignation and demanded to know what was going on. According to contemporaneous notes written by Jacobs, Nader said he had confiscated the files because a year earlier, Jacobs had signed checks for magazine subscriptions without Nader's permission. Nader also accused Jacobs of writing a check to himself for about $75 for expenses. Dismayed and shaken, Jacobs searched for a new job. He was being seriously considered for a position as a staff member on the Senate Select Intelligence Committee, which required a routine background check conducted by the FBI, which collects raw data on individuals but does not seek to confirm it. While waiting to hear about the job, Jacobs was told that questions had been raised about his character, honesty, and trustworthiness. He subsequently learned that the source of the innuendos was Nader. According to Jacobs' son, Nick, to find out why he was denied a security clearance, Jacobs asked for and received a list of the people the FBI had interviewed and what they'd said. He told the agency the accusations were untrue. Nick says he has repeatedly asked the FBI for access to his father's FBI file, but although the agency has said the file is okay to release, he has so far not received it. On August 7, 1975, Jacobs wrote his former friend a letter expressing his distress. Quote, "I thought we had settled after our long talk in April. If I misunderstood you that day, it was surely the most costly misunderstanding in the 24 years I've known you. I was prepared to let you go your way in the hope that you would let me go mine, and I was feeling very kindly disposed toward you. That was until I learned of your statement to the FBI. The impact of that statement was as if I had been kicked in the stomach. We must have some sort of resolution to undo the damage done by your statements. As the record now stands, it will be an impediment for the rest of my life," unquote. It may be hard now to fathom just how credible and influential Nader was at the time. He had taken on General Motors and won, launched a new movement on behalf of consumers, and recruited earnest young raiders to work for organizations founded solely on his credibility. By 1975, Nader was regarded as an exemplar of righteousness, the ultimate advocate of the ordinary citizen. For someone of his stature to impugn the reputation of a former employee to the FBI was devastating. According to a statement Jacobs wrote after he was dismissed, Nader told the FBI that Jacobs was fired for skimming money from the Center for the Study of Responsive Law and other irregularities. In the affidavit that Jacobs drafted in the hope of clearing his name with the FBI, he wrote, quote, I was the only person Mr. Nader trusted with his extensive and complicated financial dealings. I regularly signed his name to leases, correspondence, contracts, tax returns, reports to government agencies, and bank and stock brokerage accounts. Mr. Nader was aware of the fact that I regularly signed his name to these documents and would often specifically request we do so because he didn't want his real signature widely known. The fact is that I did sign the checks which were in accord with the regular practice of payment of legitimate office expenses. Unquote. In the affidavit, Jacobs indicated that the reason he decided to leave Nader's employ was his growing concern about the way Nader handled his personal and professional finances. Jacobs outlined in some detail what he characterized as questionable practices regarding taxes, bookkeeping, investments, and stock transactions. He wrote, quote, Although Mr. Nader was earning approximately $500,000 per year in personal income, he paid little or no taxes since he deducted various expenses of his operations as, quote, business expenses, unquote, or he made contributions to charitable organizations, unquote, controlled by him, Jacobs continued. Quote, He also engaged in what I viewed to be questionable end-of-year tax juggling, often predating or postdating checks to get a deduction in a particular year. He would often pad travel expenses and double bill for travel expenses when he had two engagements in a particular out-of-town city, unquote. The former associate also charged that Nader's nonprofit enterprises were run with very little oversight by their boards. No independent outside audits were made of any of the Nader organizations until various states required public citizen statements, unquote. Jacobs also wrote in the affidavit that Nader was inordinately harsh in his dealings with his employees and others. Although he had amassed a reserve of over $2 million in various foundations, organizations, and in his personal brokerage account, he paid extremely low wages and often refused to pay employees and others for work done, unquote. Jacobs never filed his affidavit with the FBI, but some of the allegations it contains were confirmed by two former associates of Nader's on the Congress Project, an ambitious, Nader-sponsored undertaking to investigate every single member of Congress up for re-election in 1972. Attempts to verify information about other people mentioned in the affidavit were unsuccessful because they could not be found or were unwilling to comment about events that occurred 30 years ago. The bottom line is, my husband knew everything, unquote, says Lenore Jacobs about her late husband. When he died, everything died with him. Every file or notes that he had, Ralph took and would not return. There's no corroborating it because my husband's dead. It was a horrific time in our lives, not to put too fine a point on it, unquote. Whether Jacobs' accusations about Nader's financial dealings were true, or just a counter-threat to get Nader to recant his statement remains uncertain. Salon was unable to independently confirm the allegation without legal and financial impropriety. Nader refused to comment for this story, though he was informed about the nature of Jacobs' charges. What's certain is that shortly after Jacobs prepared his affidavit, Nader sent a letter to the FBI retracting what he had said about Jacobs. In a classic non-apology apology, Nader wrote, This is to inform you that all outstanding differences have been settled, which were insignificant in nature. In light of the above, I would now recommend Mr. Jacobs for a position of trust and confidence with the U.S. government, unquote. But the damage was done. The highly qualified Jacobs didn't get the job with the Senate Select Intelligence Committee or any other position that required a security clearance. He reluctantly took a job on the staff of Bella Abzug, the late firebrand Democratic congressman from New York, and worked on Capitol Hill until he retired in 1994. Jacobs died in 1998 of a neurological disease. I believe the way Ted portrays things is accurate, unquote, says Nick Zill, a former Nader associate who knew Jacobs when he worked for Nader. Ted was a straight shooter and not a frivolous person at all. He was very dedicated to Nader's causes. Though Zill didn't know the details of the men's falling out before being shown Jacobs' notes, he said he is not at all surprised by the characterization of Nader's vindictiveness. Zill and his former wife, Ann Zill, both worked for the Congress Project. The Zills, too, had a bitter parting of ways with Nader. And we're going to take a look now at Nader's activities against Toby Moffett, a former Democratic congressman, skipping down. While Jacobs may have been damaged more than anyone else by Nader, he was by no means the last intimate associate to suffer Nader's wrath. These weren't just marginal people with whom he disagreed, says Toby Moffett, a former Democratic congressman and another early and close associate of Nader's. These are people who would have fallen on a sword for him. Like Nader, Moffett grew up in Connecticut. Their fathers, both Lebanese immigrants, were good friends. When Moffett finished graduate school, his father urged him to get in touch with Nader, who was already a national icon. To Moffett's surprise, not only did Nader take his call, but he asked him to return to Connecticut and start an organization that would later become the model for citizen action groups around the country. I saw a lot of Ralph because he would come back to visit his parents in Connecticut. I would stay and eat with the family. To me, he was a gigantic hero, unquote. After working closely with the old family friend, Moffett ran for Congress from Connecticut in 1974 and won. 3 months after I was elected, Nader attacked me, says Moffett, so our relationship began to sour pretty quickly, unquote. According to Moffett, Nader launched the first of numerous attacks against him over an aircraft noise reduction bill. While the bill stipulated that noise reduction measures would be funded mostly by the airlines, they were also to be subsidized by a tax on airplane travelers, not the general public, which Nader dismissed as a corporate handout. Moffett, along with nearly every environmental group, supported the bill. Quote, "It was an important piece of legislation that was supported by a coalition of progressive members of Congress, and it passed. Of course, now the Bush administration is tearing it apart." Unquote. Nader continued to criticize Moffett during his 4 terms in Congress, which was disturbing enough, but as with Al Gore, Nader would eventually play a crucial part in ending Moffett's career in elective office. After a 4th term in the House, Moffett ran for the Senate against Lowell Weicker, a Republican, in 1982. Quote, "My opponent was running these ads attacking me. The National Rifle Association was hammering me from the right," says Moffett. "And then Ralph Nader came up to Connecticut and endorsed him. I lost by a very slim margin. My family and I and my supporters, we just had this blind rage and fury about it. So what he did in 2000 was no shock to me, and what he's doing now is no shock. It's always been about him and his ego," unquote. "He has no interest in being a constructive part of anything," continues Moffett. "No one can name a coalition he's been in where he really rolled up his sleeves and tried to get something done." And still later, noting an aspect of the Nader candidacy in 2000. In 2000, again with the Green Party, he ran a full-fledged campaign, raising and spending money to get on the ballot in all 50 states. He drew huge crowds at places like Madison Square Garden in New York and Key Arena in Seattle. While he assured Democrats that he wouldn't campaign late in the election season in key battleground states, he reneged on that promise, zeroing in on Florida, Oregon, and New Hampshire in the last few weeks before the election. By the way, Nader apologists cite the obvious and well-documented vote tampering in Florida and saying, well, it wasn't Nader's fault. Well, it was no vote tampering that I've heard of in New Hampshire. And I think one of the real significant aspects of the Nader campaign was to basically fulfill what Karl Rove had in mind for Bush's image. Basically, Rove was trying to portray Bush as a centrist and that there really were no outstanding differences between the two candidates. That was exactly what Ralph Nader was proposing. In For the Record 264 about Ralph Nader, I noted that among the many things he's done was to forbid the editor of Multinational Monitor, a publication that he had founded, from discussing the correlation between CIA covert action abroad and multinational corporate policy. I noted that, and I thought that was very strange. One of the things to bear in mind, and I'm not saying this is definitively the case, but one of the things to bear in mind is the candidacy of Eugene McCarthy in 1968. Eugene McCarthy was a United States senator from Minnesota who ran on an anti-Vietnam War ticket and helped to put Richard Nixon in office by discrediting the Democratic campaign. A book called Who's Who in the CIA by Julius Motter identifies, alleges that Eugene McCarthy was in fact a career operative representative of the Central Intelligence Agency. McCarthy's candidacy, by the way, was bankrolled by a guy named Stuart Mott, a well-known philanthropist and heir to a large block of GM stock. His family had a line of Apple products as a main line of business. Stuart Mott, interestingly enough, at the same time that he was bankrolling the candidacy of Eugene McCarthy, was also bankrolling a company called Environmental Industries, either Incorporated or Limited, which sounds really neat and green. It was actually the parent company for manufacturing Mitch Werbel's Ingram Mach 10 and Mach 11 machine pistols, favorite tools of death squads and covert operators abroad. The Environmental Industries was a pun, basically. The idea was that the company had a contribution to make in the area of population control. One does wonder about Ralph Nader and whether perhaps he might actually be a wolf in sheep's clothing. Perhaps he's just a loose cannon, but in any event, I would bear that in mind. Speaking of wolves in sheep's clothing, a very interesting fellow is Al Sharpton, who ran on the Democratic primaries, has been very critical of the Democratic Party, and also helped to put a Republican in office in New York City, Mr. Bloomfield. This is an article from the Village Voice of February 5th of 2004. It's called Sleeping with the GOP. Subtitled, A Bush Covert Operative Takes Over Al Sharpton's Campaign. And it's a very, very interesting association indeed, that between Al Sharpton and Roger Stone. The article reads in part, Roger Stone, the longtime Republican dirty tricks operative who led the mob that shut down the Miami-Dade County recount and helped make George W. Bush president in 2000, is financing, staffing, and orchestrating the presidential campaign of Reverend Al Sharpton. Though Stone and Sharpton have tried to reduce their reliance to a curiosity, suggesting that all they do is talk occasionally, a Voice investigation has documented an extraordinary array of connections. Stone played a pivotal role in putting together Sharpton's pending application for federal matching funds, getting dollars in critical states from family members and political allies at odds with everything Sharpton represents. He's also helped stack the campaign with a half dozen incongruous top aides who've worked for him in prior campaigns. He's even boasted about engineering six-figure loans to Sharpton's National Action Network, or NAN, and allowing Sharpton to use his credit card to cover thousands in NAN costs, neither of which he could legally do for the campaign. In a wide-ranging Voice interview Sunday, Stone confirmed his matching fund and staffing roles but refused to comment on the NAN subsidiaries. Skipping down, more about Stone. Recruited in 2000 by his friend James Baker, the former Secretary of State, to spearhead the GOP street forces in Miami, Stone is apparently confident that he can use the Democrat-bashing preacher to damage the party's eventual nominee, just as Sharpton himself bragged he did in the New York mayoral campaign of 2001. In his 2002 book, Al on America, Sharpton wrote that he felt the city's Democratic Party had to be taught a lesson in 2001, insisting that Mark Green, who defeated the Sharpton-backed Fernando Ferrer in a bitter runoff, had disrespected him and minorities. Adding that the party, quote, still had to be taught one nationally, unquote, he warned, again quoting, A lot of 2004 will be about what happened in New York in 2001. It's about dignity. In 2001, Sharpton engaged in a behind-the-scenes dialogue with campaign aides to Republican Mike Bloomberg while publicly disparaging Green. And skipping down. Just as Stone has a history of political skullduggery, Sharpton has a very little-noticed history of Republican machinations inconsistent with his fiery rhetoric. He endorsed Al D'Amato in 1986, appeared with George Pataki 2 days before his 1994 race against Mario Cuomo, invited Ralph Nader to his headquarters on the eve of the 2000 vote, befriended Bill Powers when he was the state GOP chair, and debuted as a preacher in the church of a black minister who was also a Brooklyn Republican district leader. The current co-chair of his presidential campaign gave as much mud to Bush Cheney as he did to Sharpton, and many of the black businessmen supporting his campaign or NAN have strong GOP ties. His conduit in the Bloomberg campaign, Harold Doley III, was the son of the first black with a seat on Wall Street. A major NAN backer over the years, Doley Jr. was appointed to positions in five Republican administrations, including Bush's. Stone, whose Miami mob even jostled a visiting Sharpton during the recount, said recently in the American Spectator that if Sharpton were to run, quote, as an independent, unquote, in the 2006 Hillary Clinton race, she would be sunk, implicitly suggesting that his opposition may be a precursor to another Stone Sharpton mission. In his book Too Close to Call, New Yorker columnist Jeffrey Toobin exposed Baker's tapping of Stone, as well as Stone and his Cuban wife Nadia's role in firing up Cuban protesters, with Stone calling the shots the day of the shutdown over a walkie-talkie in a building across the street from canvassing board headquarters. The Stone mob was chanting Sharpton's slogan, "No justice, no peace," when the board stopped the count, which was universally seen as the turning point in the battle that made Bush president. By the way, it's also noted later in the article that Stone was the registered agent in America for the Argentina's intelligence services, which is quite interesting. In a column in the San Francisco Examiner a number of years ago, Warren Hinkle alleged that Al Sharpton had worked for the CIA in Grenada. The allegation was not sourced, so there's no way of knowing what the source was for Hinkle's allegation, but it did appear a number of years ago. Last thing we're going to look at, and this again is in the fine area, that gray area between reality and paranoia. One of the things I've noted in a number of programs is that, in fact, environmental modification weaponry has advanced to a relatively sophisticated state, and indeed, in For the Record 69, I not only quoted from a treaty that was concluded between the U.S. and Soviet Union, prohibiting, among other things, the manipulation of earthquakes as weapons of war, but I also noted that, in fact, in 1997, then-Secretary of Defense William Cohen stated that terrorist groups were working on developing Tesla technology as a weapon of mass destruction. In For the Record 69 as well, I noted that Nikola Tesla had triggered an earthquake successfully in New York City in the late 19th century. As people think about a terrorist incident which might happen before the election, or think about the various things that we've mused on, consider the possibility of a major earthquake in California and what that might do to the electoral process. This is from the Yahoo website. It is dated April 15th of 2004. Expert warns California to brace for big quake by September. A U.S. geophysicist has set the scientific world ablaze by claiming to have cracked a holy grail, accurate earthquake prediction, and warning that a big one will soon hit Southern California. By the way, the prediction by Professor Vladimir Kelesborok of UCLA said, he has made a chilling prediction that a quake measuring at least 6.4 magnitude on the Richter scale will hit a 31,200 square kilometer area of Southern California by September 5th. It's also a story that appeared in the San Francisco Chronicle of January 9th of this year, in which another scientist notes that there may very well be a major quake on the San Andreas Fault later this year, meaning 2004. With Arnold Schwarzenegger ruling the roost, and with California a major liberal state, the Bay Area, a major area of hotbed of liberal activity, consider what a major earthquake in California might do to the elections. It could lead to them being postponed. If it was sufficiently severe, it could collapse not only the California economy, but the U.S. economy as well, perhaps even leading to a suspension of the Constitution. And, of course, we've got Arnold Schwarzenegger ruling the roost here in California. Incidentally, he recently replaced the heads of the California National Guard and California Highway Patrol with his own appointees. So who knows what could happen, but if in fact there's a major quake in California and if it should devastate the Bay Area, I may not be around to recap it. So if such a thing were to take place, and I'm not saying it will, note this program for future reference and access For the Record number 69. And that we'll see what happens. I'll take up this subject again at greater length. That concludes For the Record 468, Through a Glass Darkly, a look at the 2004 elections, being recorded on 7/11/2004. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.